This special program was brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the Jane Spirit Foundation. And every Wednesday, usually at 11, today at 11:18, we have a conversation about everyone's favorite subject, at least everyone listening's favorite subject, and that is taste. Thank you for your patience if you've been listening live. If you're listening to the podcast, you won't know why I'm saying that. But I'm delighted that we now have in the studio with us today's guest and someone I'm so honored to count as an old friend, an expert, a world expert on olive oil, on Italian cooking, on the food of all of the Mediterranean, not to mention so many great other things she's thought and written about as an author and historian. Please join me in welcoming Nancy Jenkins to the studio. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you very much. I didn't realize this was called Taste, but that seems so appropriate for what I'm doing now.
Well, let's start right there then. What are you doing now? You are working on an olive oil workshop.
Well, I am. I can't believe that I got myself into this, but I have a four-hour workshop starting at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning at the Roger Smith Hotel for this famous, soon-to-be-famous, Roger Smith Food Conference,
right.
A four-hour workshop on olive oil, during which we're going to be doing two separate tastings and a lot of talking about olive oil and some slideshows showing people how olive oil is made and et cetera, et cetera. But
okay,
the
so
thing
four
you have to emphasize,
hours.
Yeah,
right.
4 hours. Right. How did I get myself into that?
And the thing you have to emphasize is what?
Well, with olive oil, what you have to emphasize above all else is taste. And unfortunately, we in this country, and, you know, I actually include a lot of Italians in this, too, we don't know what good olive oil is supposed to taste like. And that's why we're content going into a restaurant and sitting down and the waiter comes and says, oh, would you like to try some olive oil with our bread? Well, yes, you say, feeling so Mediterranean, and you break off the bread and dip it in. And I would say 9.5 times out of 10, that olive oil is rancid.
Okay. So let's start. What does that mean?
It means that the olive oil is old. It hasn't been handled well. It has olive oil, you know, it has monounsaturated fatty acids in it. And they are protective, but they also, a lot of the fat structure in olive oil will go rancid. Just as, for instance, walnuts will go rancid,
right.
Whole wheat flour will go rancid if it's not kept under controlled.
I think we need to try to describe this because I'm forever telling people that these nuts are rancid or that bread has turned. And I don't think people understand. We're not talking about a icky, awful, I mean, well, we are, but we're not talking about some putrid taste.
No,
exactly.
Not
in
at
fact,
all.
I think some people think rancidity is the taste of walnuts, for instance.
Yes, they do, because that's all I've ever tasted.
Right.
And in actual fact, rancidity, you know, you're not going to die from eating a handful of rancid walnuts. But if you eat a handful of rancid walnuts every day of your life, you are going to have serious health consequences.
Oh, interesting.
Because that means that the fats in the walnuts or in the olive oil or in the whole grains of wheat have oxidized. And oxidation is something we want to stay away from. It's hard to stay away from it because it's a natural process,
right,
of everything that we do. You know, breathing,
right,
et cetera.
Anything that's exposed to oxygen.
Right,
any free
exactly.
radical joins and oxidizes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So let's get back to olive oil. And what is the taste of good olive oil?
Well, it has a fresh taste, first of all. It has a clean taste. It doesn't taste oily. It doesn't leave a greasy film in your mouth. I mean, it is a fat, so obviously you're going to understand that it's a fat. But you can tell the difference. I tasted an olive oil just this morning, first thing before coming over here, that I'm going to offer as my first olive oil tomorrow. And I just went out to supermarket chain that shall remain nameless and bought a bottle of not inexpensive olive oil, $20 for a half liter, off the shelf. And the woman I was staying with said, how do you know there's something wrong with this? And I said, I can just tell. Just tell. And I tasted it, and it was rancid. And it may have been good olive oil at one time. I doubt it very much. But it's been handled badly ever since.
Okay, so let's give some pointers to people listening. First of all, doesn't matter if it's green or clear, does it? Or does was the color of the oil tell you anything?
No, the color of the oil doesn't tell you anything except that green oils tend to come from younger, that is, less mature olives, and golden-colored oils tend to come from mature olives.
Okay.
I prefer the greener side of things, but that doesn't mean that there aren't some great olive oils that are kind of yellow in color. Where you want to look for the green is in the color of the bottle, however.
Because
a green bottle or a dark bottle, or better yet, a tin, is protecting the olive oil from light, because light and heat are the two great enemies of olive oil.
Okay, light and heat and oxygen.
Yes, oxygen, yeah.
Enemies of olive oil. Okay, so we choose one. I don't even know where to start, because these are questions I get all the time, and you keep reading about them, and the information doesn't really change, but it's hard to sink in. So you go to an unnamed supermarket, we'll call it Fairway, or
yeah,
maybe Whole Foods,
yeah,
and you see a wall full of olive oils. What do you do?
Well, I start, first of all, by looking for those dark bottles. I don't want olive oil that's being brought to me in a clear glass bottle, because that's dangerous. Dangerous for the quality
of the olive
oil. Right.
Yeah. It won't kill you.
Then I look at the label, and I look to see where the olive oil is from. And if it says, 100% Italian, cold-pressed, blah, 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 olive oil, then I look to see where the olives really come from. And if it says our olives are selected from all over Italy, then I usually tend to pass on it unless I know already something about that producer. But the ordinary consumer doesn't know something about that producer. So you pass on that. You look, basically, if you're looking for the finest olive oil, you're looking for an olive oil that is produced on an estate where the olives are grown and they're harvested and they're processed and they're bottled on that estate, and it should say that on the label.
And you may also see there are some EU markings or something.
There are. The EU now requires labels to indicate the origin of olive oil. So you'll find Mediterranean olive oils, and you'll see carefully selected olives from Tunisia, Morocco, Spain, Greece, Italy.
Not so careful. The selection process there is not so careful, I bet.
But some indications are the denomination of origin, which can be DO. Or DOP or AOC in France. These are all terms that basically mean denomination of origin is controlled. So the oil has been produced from olives grown in a certain region, harvested in a certain period of time, and processed in a certain way. Doesn't necessarily, as with wine, I'm sure you've had the experience of buying AOC Bordeaux wines and they turn out to be rot gut.
Right.
It doesn't mean that it's good. It just means that the production has been controlled.
Right.
So it's a better guarantee than nothing else.
So let's take a step back from olive oil. Like you mentioned the ritual in Italian restaurants in America, and even now, to some surprise in Italy, of the pouring of the oil onto a small dish for you to dip your bread in. I was recently with a mutual friend, Carla Capablo, and she said, if oil is so precious, why would any Italian just waste it in a dish on the table, was what she said to me. But where does oil fit in the culture of the food cultures around the Mediterranean? Is it just something we fry stuff in, or is it more than that?
Oh, I think it's a good deal more than that. Although I think, olive oil is getting more and more expensive. Good olive oil is getting more and more expensive because it's more and more costly to produce. It almost has to be handmade in order to be good. So people will turn away from it for that reason. Mm. And people will buy, especially in a country like Spain or like Italy, that's suffering from real dire economic states. Mm-hmm. They will buy a $2 a liter bottle of, or 2 euro a liter bottle of olive oil in the local supermarket and be perfectly content with it. It is not good olive oil, believe you me. It's probably, in Italy's case, it's probably been imported from Spain and put into bottles by some major industrial producer. And you know, they want to think they've got olive oil on their
right.
beans or whatever, but they don't necessarily. But it is used widely in cooking. I don't know any culture that that cooks with olive oil to the extent that the Spanish do. But uh-huh. the Spanish, almost everything that's cooked in Spain is cooked in olive oil.
Now, I've heard people say that you can't fry things in olive oil because it has a low temperature
smoke
yes,
point. Indeed. I believe it's the canola people who are putting that out.
Really?
No, it does not have a low temperature. Listen, the joy of cooking says an appropriate temperature for deep fat frying is, I think she says, 360 degrees. Olive oil is certainly good up to 400 degrees. I'm talking Fahrenheit,
right.
obviously, and even above that. And it's not going to, the other thing you hear all the time is that it's going to turn into hydrogenated oil if you heat it up. That's impossible. You can't make hydrogenated oil on your kitchen stove. It's just absolutely impossible. So yeah, it's perfectly safe to fry with. It's not going to explode into flames on your stovetop. And in fact, I always like to quote Elizabeth David, who always said that, well, let's see, she said the Greeks, the Jews, and the Italians all produced excellent fried food because all three cultures fry with olive oil. Mm. And Elizabeth David, for me, is the sine qua non of food authorities.
Right. What about California and California oil?
Yeah, there's a lot of oil being produced in California. You know, they when I first started talking with them, which was probably about 4 years ago or so, and I'm not going to be able to remember the name of the guy who runs the Olive Center at UC Davis, Dan Flynn. Dan Flynn runs this place called the Olive Center at UC Davis, and he said they, at that point, they had 1% only of the U.S. market, and they wanted to increase that to 10% over the next 10 years. And I think they probably will. The curious thing is that the major producer of the maximum amount of oil in California is California Olive Ranch, and it's owned by Spaniards.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's a Spanish industrial complex that's invested in enormous territories in California. This thing called super high density planting, where the trees are planted so close together that from a distance it kind of looks like a vineyard. Mm. They call it hedgerow planting, and they can mechanically harvest and they can mechanically prune. These are the two times that you need a lot of mano d'opera. You need a lot of manpower if you're going to do it by hand. But if you can do it by machine, you save a lot on that. Plus, they can get the olives from the harvest into the processing within 2 hours. Mm. So their oil is very, very fresh. So they're making a good oil. Mm-hmm. And you can find it more increasingly, not just in kind of fancy shops, but also in ordinary supermarkets like the Hannafords that I go to in Maine, always has California Olive Ranch in some place or another. It's a fine oil. It, to me, however, I know I'm going to get just scads of rotten tomatoes thrown at me if I say this, but to me it's a little bit like California wine. You know, they make very good wine, but as somebody said, nobody ever wrote a poem about it.
Okay, and if anyone listening has a poem about California olive oil or perhaps California wine, why don't you send it to us? And you can do that at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or maybe it's a haiku and you could tweet it to us at Taste Matters HRN. Let's get out of the granularity of olive oil, which we got into very quickly.
Yeah.
Easy to do with you, and let's talk a little bit about you and your life writing and living and studying around the Mediterranean and the coast of Maine. And I want to talk about this notion of the Mediterranean diet, which I know that you are also an expert in and recognized expert in, and some of the craziness going on these days in America with food and diets and paleo this and anti that and gluten free whatever
and fat. Right.
Now it's amazing. Right now suddenly we can eat fat again and I would just like your perspective on these things and really the role that food culture plays in diet and in eating behaviors and where we might find some place to discuss or try to evolve an American food culture that isn't just picking and choosing and medicalizing and doing. And I don't know. You've seen a lot.
Yeah, you know, I've been very lucky in my life. I've lived in the two most beautiful places in the world, coast of Maine and Tuscany. But the Mediterranean diet really is something that I focused on for a long time, going way back to the first Mediterranean diet conference, which, believe it or not, was in 1992. Mm. Seems like just yesterday.
Sure.
But the thing that's appealing about the Mediterranean diet is that it does grow out of a food culture. It's not something that a group of scientists in a university got together and said, hey, you know what? If we all eat a lot of vegetables and legumes and we cut back on red meat and we dribble olive oil all over everything, we'll be healthy. Nobody did that. It's just the way people ate and
right.
people acted and people behaved. And
which was itself the product of the geography
and
the
agriculture.
And
Yeah. And the history very strongly, because, I mean, Mediterranean culture is built on three things. And this shows up in Judaism and in Christianity very significantly, less so in Islam. But it's built on wheat, the vine, and the olive. It's called the Mediterranean Triad. And, you know, anytime you look at either one of those religions, you see evidence of it everywhere. The sacrality of these three ingredients. And it continues to this day, despite gluten-free, I think. I mean, the Italians are crazy for gluten-free right now, but the Italians will jump on any bandwagon that's
right.
going
right.
for about 6 months, and then they'll jump off again. I've always thought, too, that the great attraction of what's called, in quotes, the Mediterranean diet for Americans is that it's a vocabulary. Because the way people eat, the foods people eat, constitute a vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And the vocabulary of the Mediterranean is very, very familiar to Americans. We all, you know, if there's anybody, I mean, there are lots of people who don't do any cooking at all. But if there's anybody who does any cooking, they know how to boil pasta and make spaghetti. They may not make a pizza, but they know what a pizza consists of. The vocabulary of this Mediterranean diet is very familiar. There are no strange foods. There are no strange techniques. It's easy
right.
to adapt it.
But just to take the metaphor a little longer, perhaps the grammar is where we fall down. That
exactly.
The way things go together and make meaning,
right.
literally
exactly.
and figuratively.
No, you know, my daughter and I are working on a pasta book now, and one of the things that we're confronting is this American phenomenon of making the pasta the main course in a meal.
Mm.
I had lunch in a restaurant yesterday where the chef had made this absolutely delicious bolognese sauce that he served with house-made... they were wide noodles in any case. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was perfectly delicious, but the pasta was drowning in sauce in a way that you would never find in Italy. In Italy, the pasta forms a kind of foundation, and the sauce... I go back to Sidney Mintz and his theory about the core foods on the plate. You had a core carbohydrate and a protein that helped the carbohydrate go down because it adds something sexy
something
to the carbohydrate, to the bland basic carbohydrate.
We're going to think about basic carbohydrates and sexy condiments. While we take a quick break, I'm talking to Nancy Jenkins, author, historian, olive oil expert, and all-around lovely, smart person. You're listening to Taste Matters.
She's dancing by herself in a mother's summer dress. Oh, kid, she doesn't need your help. She studied art in Spain. Tall boys across her brain. Yeah, tall boys, men, they'll do anything. They sat her in the shade, threw her a parade. All lined up, marching back and forth all day. She's boy crazy. She's boy crazy. Oh, she's boy crazy. She's boy crazy. And she's coming for you. She's coming for you.
Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with author and historian Nancy Jenkins about olive oil and the Mediterranean diet and your new book on pasta. So you were saying this American thing about making pasta the main course. Let's talk about that a little bit. Where should pasta be, or where is it in an Italian context?
Not just in Italy, but also in, I think, in other parts of the Mediterranean, where it's not obviously not as significant as it is in Italy, but it's almost always considered a first course, a primo. And the value of that, in a way, is that the carbohydrate fills you up. Mm. So you don't eat, if you have a grilled steak or a piece of chicken or a piece of fish for the main course, you don't eat as much of it. You don't need as much of it. It's also a place, I remember you asking me in Florence once, where are the vegetables? And I said, they're all around you. You just don't know where to look. They're in the pasta sauce. Pasta sauce has lots and lots of vegetables in it. Even that sauce I was just talking about, a bolognese, which is basically a meat sauce, but still there's a lot of vegetables going on in there.
Right. So people are so fascinated by Italy and the Mediterranean, although I think even when we say Mediterranean, they mostly mean Italy, honestly.
So, yeah.
And in fact, they probably mean Tuscany.
Right.
let's call it what it is. And yet things there have changed drastically, even in the short time I've been going, and you've been living there more than 30 years.
More than 40 years.
40
now.
Years.
Yeah.
Wow. And let's talk.
I'm older than I look.
can you tell that on the radio? let's talk a little bit about that, because we often, you know, even with this idea of a Mediterranean diet, we objectify something and it freezes in time, and that was from a long time ago also. But what's going on there in food, and what do you see?
I see the same thing that's happened in this country, but I see it's happening much later there. It happened in France already, I think. It's the introduction of mass-produced food, basically, whether it's mass-grown food from, you know, big industrial-type farms or actual, you know, frozen and microwavable and so forth foods. And it's a consequence of a modern economy, I think, because people don't have the time, or they don't perceive themselves as having the time any longer to be able to actually prepare meals. And in some senses, they're right, because when I think back to my original exposure in Tuscany to the way people lived, there were 1, 2, 3, 4 mature women in that household.
These are neighbors of yours.
My neighbors, the people who lived there, Mita Antolini and her family. And Mita was the youngest of these four. But they did all of the vegetable gardening, the orto, as opposed to the big fields. And they did all of the tending of the farmyard animals, the chickens and the rabbits and the ducks and the geese, and they prepared all the meals from scratch because they didn't have any transportation. They had no way to go to town and buy all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's why they made pasta too. They made pasta only on Sundays because it was labor intensive, but they weren't able to go into town and buy a box of pasta and take it home. But I think that all of that has changed enormously in Italy in the last 25 years, really. And more so in central Italy in the north, much more so than in the south. I've been spending a lot of time in Puglia lately. In fact, I'm transferring my Amarolio olive oil experiences to Puglia from Tuscany because I think it's a fascinating region. And I feel when I'm down there in Puglia and in Sicily, and probably in Calabria too, although I don't spend so much time there, I feel as if I'm in touch with the Italy that I first knew when I first went there in the late 60s and early 70s.
Interesting. And is that a function of any sort of systematic or cultural thing, or is that a function of money and the economy?
I think everything is a function of money in the end. And there, the economy is much more limited than it is in the north. There are fewer opportunities for women than there are in the north. I mean, for women going out to work in a salary position. And there's more of a tradition of women staying home and maintaining the household in some way.
Mm. I wonder why money means we stop cooking. I mean, I know you described a peasant lifestyle, let's say, when you first got there, but in some ways, it's interesting to me because, you know, when you look at what people are doing with their time, you know, whether it's looking at their phones like I do or whatever, there still is time.
There's plenty of time.
But we give it up easily when we get money, and well, then we eat poorly.
Yeah, we get convinced that we don't have time. Right. The whole economy of our country is based on, well, it isn't entirely based on this. It's based on a lot of things. But one of the things that it's based on is convincing consumers that they don't have time to do it themselves, and therefore they have to consume what's already been prepared for them. If you think about the amount of food that any one of us among our friends eats regularly, the way we eat regularly, it's so different from the way even our grandparents ate. And our grandparents, you know, you're not going back 100 years. Right. You're going back maybe 50 years. And people ate in a very different way. They had, I mean, the other thing that's charming about the Italians that just kills me every time I think of it, something like 70% of the country still goes home for lunch every day.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Even in the cities everywhere.
Yes,
yeah. That's remarkable. And
that means that they're dining in the family. And that, to me, is the basis of the Mediterranean diet, is this sense of gathering the family around the table or gathering friends around the table and doing it regularly, not just for Christmas and Easter and Passover and blah, 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 but really focusing on a weekly, at least, assembly.
Right.
Around the table.
I mean, even some of the students who you've met that I've taught over the years from NYU's food studies program, who've gone into the school system, the public school system in Florence, the kids at third and fourth grade have to sit around the table for 35 minutes with their teacher and eat.
Yes, exactly. They do. And, you know, here's another thing that was very interesting. The last group that I dealt with in last June in Florence, one of them came up to me and said, yeah, I've been looking for food carts in Florence and I don't find them anywhere. Can you tell me where I could go? Because I want to do something about food carts in New York and in Florence. And I said, well, you really have to go to the markets, and there what you find are the tripe carts. And, you know, New York student kind of blanches a little bit when you mention tripe. But, in fact, Lisa Sasson took me aside, and she said, you know, what they're looking for are snacks. For some of these kids, they never eat a real meal. They eat snack after snack after snack, and they might be healthy snacks.
Right, right.
But they don't have that experience of sitting down at a table with a group of fellow people sharing food and sharing conversation.
Which I think is as important in sort of structuring eating behaviors as anything. I was at a conference recently where we were talking about that experience of sitting around the table, and it isn't just that you enjoy the food together. It's also that someone says, don't eat that. You've got too much. You know, you're socialized into behaviors and norms that when you're alone or standing up or on the run or at your desk at work, no one's around
do that. Well, the interesting thing, I'm sorry to keep comparing Italians to Americans to the dismay of Americans, but when I was thinking about that, I was thinking that Italians always have a social encounter around food. Even if you go to the bar for a coffee, you have a social engagement with the barista. You exchange some words with him or her, even if it's just about the weather. You don't just go up and plunk your money down as you do at Starbucks.
Well, here you exchange the words, hurry up, you know. So you're in the few minutes we have left, I feel there's a crack here to talk a little bit about something that I think people listening to this radio station know about, but you might have some insight into, and it's the whole slow food movement. I mean, we're talking about the table. We're talking about some notion of taking time, that food is not just about nutrients. What do you think about that and where it's gone in the 25 years or what we might have?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a real love-hate relationship with slow food, I have to say. I thought it was a terrific idea from the start. And I think they have been very important in Italy in recognizing a lot of the small producers of really valuable products, also in a few other countries around the Mediterranean, but principally in Italy. My biggest problem was that it became a totally Italy-focused organization, and it almost seemed to be in the business of promoting Italian food products, and that steers me away from it a little bit.
Right.
But I think on the whole, it's been very valuable in making people think about where food comes from and what we risk if we lose these traditions. And there's a big movement, you know, we mentioned briefly gluten-free, et cetera. I think there's a big movement toward recovering some of these, not antique grains, but older types of wheat, pre-1950s types of wheat that are perhaps a lot more healthy for our gut than modern strains of wheat are. And that's a kind of slow food reflection.
This sort of heirloom pursuit, even beyond wheat, but in other things.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And it doesn't have to be something that the Etruscans did. It can be something that your great-grandfather did instead of your grandfather. I guess I'd have to say that on the whole, it's been very positive. But I detest the kind of smug, condescending way they carry on. And right. That really gets me in the end.
Well, somehow 30 minutes went by really quickly, and I think we're just about at the end of them. Thank you so much for coming. Next time we'll talk about wheat,
absolutely.
Leave olive oil on the side. and if any, I don't know if there's still space left at the Roger Smith Food Conference.
Probably. I'm not sure if there is, but I'd love to have as many people as possible coming in there, and it's going to start tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, so be there.
So be there, and you'll be able to...
And if you can't do that, you can always come on my tour of Puglia in October.
Actually, I might see you there. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
So thanks again for joining us. Next week, we're going to welcome Daniel Schaefer. We're going to be talking about coffee. He's the founder of an organization called Crop to Cup, one of the other great pleasures, both in Italy and abroad, and a fascinating, often misunderstood topic, I think. So we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, let's see. What should we tell them to do, Nancy, between now and then?
Get everybody together and have a meal around the table.
Okay. Well, make sure you do that once at least before next Wednesday.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. This is Taste Matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.